everything is recyclable. The only things that might not be or where laws prevent you from doing it, like a bloody glove from a hospital, legally has to go to incineration. What makes things actually locally recyclable is just that they're intrinsically profitable to recycle. And mind you, that's only 5% of objects in our lives fit that description, because also what's the biggest megatrend in object design is cost reduction, which means every day we reduce costs out of goods, which also makes them intrinsically less recyclable.
Running a business means solving problems. I tell you how the smartest entrepreneurs do it. Hi, I'm Jason Pfeiffer, editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, and this is Problem Solvers. Big ideas can require big change. And I know that sounds obvious. What am I saying? I'm not saying anything totally new there. But the thing is that sometimes you have this big idea, right? You have this big concept that you want to introduce into a marketplace, and you realize this is going to require some fundamental shifts. And I don't even know what fundamental shifts they are. How do you tackle a giant project that you know could be so good for your business, for the world, for your consumer, but you have really no idea exactly how it's going to be built out into the world? Well, today I'm talking to someone who has done it, who has lived it. It was a big, hard project, but the lessons are changing everything. So this is a story, and we're going to talk to the CEO, and I am a obsessive recycler, and whenever I encounter something that I didn't think could be recycled, and then there was a way to recycle it, TerraCycle is always behind it. So I've always felt very fondly toward this company, but I didn't really know that much. Now, today, I get to talk to Tom Zaki, the founder and CEO of TerraCycle, who has built out this program called Loop, which we're going to talk about, a big, ambitious project that failed in many ways before it finally succeeded. How did you do it? Well, Tom, welcome to Problem Solvers.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Tom, let's zoom into Loop, but first take a moment and just explain TerraCycle to me and anyone who's maybe just come across the name, sees that I can somehow recycle like a candy wrapper through TerraCycle, but I have no idea how.
Absolutely. So, you know, for 25 years around the world, what we've been doing at TerraCycle is exactly that, creating recycling solutions for those objects, could be your cigarette butt, could be your toothbrush, that are not locally recyclable. The key issue, by the way, is what makes them not locally recyclable is simply they're not profitable to recycle based on the material value that you recover at the end. Imagine a dirty diaper, right? A lot of money to collect it, a lot of money to process it. The outputs, not that valuable, and certainly not valuable enough to pay for those aforementioined costs. So that's like the white elephant in the room. And
can I just restate that to you? In other words, the world is full of many more recyclable things than we know. The problem is just that there aren't usually the economics behind that behind that material and that recycling process for there to be a widely available path to do it.
You got it. And just to really put a fine point on it, because you're absolutely right, but it's basically everything is recyclable. The only things that might not be are where laws prevent you from doing it, like a bloody glove from a hospital legally has to go to incineration. Mm. But I've not seen a waste stream you can't recycle. Hmm. What makes things actually locally recyclable is just that they're intrinsically profitable to recycle. And mind you, that's only 5% of objects in our lives fit that description. Because also what's the biggest megatrend in object design is cost reduction, which means every day we reduce costs out of goods, which also makes them intrinsically less recyclable because there's less money to recover.
Fascinating. Okay. And so you listed off some of these things and from wrappers to cigarette butts. And so the way in which people are getting these to you is what? There's a lot of mail-in?
Yeah, so there's a whole choice. The first major choice is, are they free programs or paid programs, right? So you'll see that on our website if you ever visit it. And basically the free stuff is free because companies are funding it. So it's not intrinsically free, but it's free to the consumer. And then there's paid solutions. Typically, you know, you would use those if you can't find a free solution. Then within the solutions, there's a range of ways. Certainly what you said, there's mail-in solutions. There's also find a local drop-off point, could be a retailer, could be a school. There's a whole plethora of different choices. We even do some curbside solutions. It all depends. Maybe there's about a dozen different ways you can get the waste to us. But you know, simple examples would be things like mail it in or drop it off.
Got it. Okay. So now let's move into, you have this program called Loop, in which you're trying to do something different, because recycling isn't the only way to reduce waste and use in the world, is there? is it?
That's right. So recycling, to be clear, recovers the composition or the material an object is made from. Let's just take a soda bottle. There we would be recovering the plastic, in that case, something like PET. But you're destroying the form and the intention of that composition in that form. Both things, mind you, that also cost money to make. So better than recycling is reuse. And that's what we learned right as kids. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce is buy less, reuse is where you just clean the object, repair it maybe, use it again. And recycling is below that, where you recover the composition. And that's what we wanted to elevate.
Right, which would make sense to me, because I think if I'm holding a glass bottle and I put it in the recycling, I think it's kind of nuts that this thing has to get, I have no idea what happens to it, shattered and melted and then just turned into another bottle. We've already got the bottle. Why not just somehow clean the bottle and let someone else use it again?
You're exactly right. Exactly right. And so that was what the idea of Loop was all about. And the crazy thing, too, is that that's also, by the way, how the world was until what I would argue garbage was invented, which is really in the 1950s. You know, everything, milkmen, you know, to motor oil, to our sodas, were in these reusable vessels.
Mm, that's right. So, okay, so you have this thought, which is, let's not just be in the recycling business, let's be in the reusing business too, which is the big idea that I'm referencing at the start of this, because, okay, how do you get people to reuse something? I guess if I were you, the starting point would be, I would be thinking, okay, well, we have to create reusable containers. Number two, we've got to teach people to reuse and not throw away or recycle. And then somehow we've got to get it back from them.
That's right. It's exactly correct. And so the beginning is that first step that you mentioned. It's where we began as well, is let's talk to consumer product companies. And the nice thing about TerraCycle is we work with just about every major consumer product company. So had these relationships. And what got them interested, I would think, is two things. One, they have a lot of pressure on them around the waste of their product, right? So this is a topic they're actively looking for solutions for. And the pressure from like the Greenpeaces of the world is the primary thesis is forget recycling, go to reuse, right? So that's already there. What was most interesting in our first dialogues, which is why we got a lot of companies is to sign on, is in disposable products or products that the vessel is thrown out after the content is consumed. That bottle or that package is a cost of goods sold at 100%, right? So the wine bottle, if it costs the producer $1, that dollar is in the cost of the wine. And when you shift to reusables, the package now becomes an asset that's amortized over the number of uses. So you could even upgrade potentially from a 10-cent package to a 50-cent package. Imagine the innovation and excitement of like 500% increase in package costs, what you could do with that. But if it goes around, say 10 times, it actually costs you half per use than the original disposable package. And that was the original excitement that got, I think, around 200 major CPG companies to be like, let's start, you know, experimenting with this.
Right. Because what you're seeing in the marketplace now is a lot of companies, because they're so aware of waste and perception of waste, is they're trying to reduce the amount of material in their packaging. So people have noticed that your water bottle or your soda bottle might now feel even flimsier. And that's good in a way, right? Because it's less material. But if I'm the CPG company that's creating that, I'm thinking, ugh, my packaging is getting uglier. It doesn't have the same like quality of feel. And I don't love that. So this is, in a way, an interesting solution for them.
Exactly right. And the crazy part of what you said, that bottle becomes flimsier. By the way, the end point is everything is a pouch, right? It actually makes it less recyclable in the process. Oh. And even more important, I think, to the CPG companies, way less exciting.
Yeah.
And innovation started coming out. You know, we started working with the CPG companies like Nestle, for example, with Häagen-Dazs. They went from a paperboard, you know, ice cream pint to a double wall stainless steel ice cream vessel that like is museum quality. The thing would keep your ice cream frozen in the summer for hours, you know, and all sorts of cool things. Tide's bottle was like nothing like this. It was so amazing, you know, the type of packages that that came out. So it certainly got the juices flowing, because as your packaging designer, you're given less resource tomorrow than today to make the package, which is just progressively harder and less inspiring.
Right, which is great. So a thing that you're doing, and I just want to flag it for everyone, is as you're thinking about introducing something new to the marketplace, you have to be thinking not just what problem is being solved for TerraCycle, right? But what problem can I be solving for everyone else that I need to be involved in here? And so if you're working with CPG, I keep saying CPG, consumer packaged goods, for those who don't know. So, if you're working with them, then you have to introduce something that isn't just, hey, be involved in this because it's good for the world. That's nice, but if it doesn't help the bottom line, then people aren't going to be on board. But if you identify the problem, and the problem is that they're actually frustrated and feeling limited by the packaging, and packaging is such an important part of selling a brand on a shelf, then actually you're giving them a lot of options, and suddenly they're more on board. So, Tom, I had said that this idea ran into walls. So tell me where the problems first occurred as you tried to build out this system in which you've got reusable containers. And actually, what is the consumer supposed to even do with a reusable container?
Yeah, so the consumer experience is, Loop itself doesn't make a product or sell a product. We're like a platform in the waste management function of reuse. So basically, the first part is we work with brands. They enable reusable versions of their product. Imagine Häagen-Dazs now in stainless steel, your Tide now in reusable, beautiful packaging. That then shows up at your favorite retailer. And then as a consumer, you see that, you buy it. The only new concept is every bottle has a unique deposit attached to it, right? So that Häagen-Dazs container, you may pay a 50-cent deposit, the Coke one, maybe 10 cents, whatever. And everything is normal for you, except when it's finished. When it's done, instead of putting it in the trash or potentially your recycling bin, you bring it back to any participating store. So you could have bought it store A, but returned to store B. You throw it into the Loop bin. That gives you all your money back. So all your deposits are refunded. And then that's the consumer experience. What happens after that is we take it, we give you your deposits back, sort the packaging, clean it, and it goes right back to the manufacturer who fills it again and sells it to someone else. And the concept of waste is gone.
Right. Okay. So I love it. I'd be down. I would go and buy that stainless steel Häagen-Dazs and I would bring it back to the store. Why did this not work?
Right. And I want to emphasize, what you said is also what all consumers said everywhere. It was 100%, like, out of the gate, consumers have loved it, continue to love it everywhere we do it. So now, you know, when we started Loop, this was already 15 years into TerraCycle, which is now 10 years ago. We're in 20 countries. So we said, look, let's test this in 5 countries, put some bets on that proverbial roulette table. And we picked Canada, US, UK, France, and Japan. And we first started with brands. So we had all these brands doing this. Then we said, look, we don't want to be a retailer. Let's go to the leading retailers in all these countries and say, hey, do you guys want to distribute? So, and we got that everywhere, you know, Loblaw in Canada, Walmart in the US, and Aeon in Japan, like number one everywhere. And the retailers said, no, let's go a little slower. Let's first prove that our consumer, like our Walmart consumer, our, you know, in France, Carrefour consumer cares. How do you want to solve that? And we said, look, we'll set up a digital platform in your retailer's look and feel, but we, Loop, will run it for you where consumers order, we ship out the reusables, pick up, you know, the empties, and prove that your consumer is interested. And that all went well. And from there, after about a year of doing this, we transitioned into in-store pilots. So we said, we don't want to be a retailer that long. So, hey, we'll, you know, can you please do your function? And they all said yes. They all went in-store. And think like 10, 20 store pilots. And when you walked into one of these stores, you'd see like an aisle of, you know, 50 to 200 products. And again, it all functioned well. And yeah. Mind you, all this is a lot of work because we had to go through crazy health and safety standards and all this stuff to, like, because you can imagine if it's like a baby food jar, that baby food jar, when it goes out, you don't know what happened to it. Someone could have pooped in it, put drugs into it. I mean, sure. And you have to assume, right, the worst.
The worst, yeah.
And we were able to get that cleaned, you know, to a standard that, like, a very conservative Danone and Nestle signed off and said, yeah, we'll put new baby food and sell it to the next consumer, right? Mm. So all that hard work was working, you know, and all the traditional issues one would have with just making sure to stand up a system like this functioned. And then this is the crazy part. Mm. Now we're about 5 years in, you know, have deployed a lot of capital against it. And we started pushing the retailers to scale. Like, let's not do these dinky pilots. Let's go to thousands of stores and really make it big. And this is where we hit a wall. We kept hearing, look, it's all working. The consumer's not an issue. Operations are not an issue. It's just not incremental. It's not growing business. Yet it's adding incremental work. And so to really, like, you know, split, you know, dive into this.
Yeah.
One CPG company told it to me in a very sort of lucid state where they said, look, in the end, where are we going to spend money? We need to sell more tomorrow and do less work tomorrow. Sell more revenue, less work, more profit. Mm-hmm. And so the way we can do that best is if we are a shampoo company, we're going to invent conditioner. If we're laundry detergent, we're going to invent fabric softener. If we're whatever, toothpaste, we're going to invent mouthwash. Mm-hmm. That is how you do that. It's why the range of stuff we buy keeps growing, you know, and we keep buying more sort of things to fill a particular need, right?
Right. Basically, the pathway to growth, which would be a kind of obvious way of thinking about it, is every company is looking at the problem they solve for a consumer, and therefore what is another problem that consumer trusts them to solve for. How else can I take my brand familiarity and awareness and leverage and just expand it outward? So that's the mindset of the folks that you're working with, which makes total sense. And so what you're saying is, because they're thinking like that and they're seeing that as the opportunity, that it's hard to carve away energy and resources from those efforts towards something like Loop. Is that right?
Well, and why? Because if we suddenly make this amazing Häagen-Dazs container, people will buy it, but they're not going to buy two ice creams. They're just going to, instead of buying their chocolate ice cream in a disposable tub, they're now going to buy it in this cool reusable tub. So there's no net incrementality in the end. I mean, there's a bit of first mover advantage stuff, but the bigger the company, the less they seem to care about that. They care about what is the net effect on the market.
Right.
And the net effect is it would be a transition, not growing the total volume of orange juice shampoo or insect repellent, you know, being
purchased. Right. Just because that Häagen-Dazs comes in a nice container doesn't mean I start buying double the amount of Häagen-Dazs.
Exactly. You still buy your chocolate pint if that's what you're into, right?
Right.
And yet the problem is then we're asking you to enable this whole brand new package form and have the health, the muscle to health and safety muscle that used packaging is coming back into your supply chain. All of this is a bunch of incremental cost. Mm. And so it stays in pilot because there is enough public pressure on the brands to like show that they're caring and demonstrating movement. So that's why there is greater than zero effort, but it gets stuck in this moment. And the crazy part is, you know, when Loop launched in 2019 is when we made it public, a bunch of other sort of reuse examples came up. And today, you know, 7 years later, almost all of them are dead, just like most of our pilots died along the way as well.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, that's the brick wall.
Okay, yeah, this is super, super interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people would have thought the problem here might be with the consumer who's going to say that they would love to do this, but then won't actually do it. Or the problem is with the retailer who's not going to want to create the space for this. But actually, interestingly, the problem that you're locating is with the manufacturer, the company that's making the product in the first place, because even though you were solving a problem for them in theory in giving them an opportunity to create more appealing packaging, what they're realizing is that more appealing packaging doesn't instantly equal higher velocity of sales, and so now they're just not sure that this is worth the resource spend.
You got it. Exactly right. And now we got lucky in France. So everywhere the pilots just wouldn't scale. And we just said, look, let's stop them because we're losing money on them. If we're not going to scale, we're not going to keep investing in them. So we basically made that decision. And all pilots shut down except France. Now, what was unique in France is that France has laws that they passed that both carrots and sticks that are really helping reuse succeed. The stick, if you will, is that there is a law that by next year, a supermarket must dedicate 10% of its floor space to reusable offerings. So it's almost like mandating it. And then on this, the carrot is that there are also really good subsidies to help offset some of the costs. And so in France, It kept scaling.
Because everyone's got the incentives to do it now.
Correct. And now, one of the challenges is we sat back, like, that's lovely and that's great, but we can't rely on, like, fantastic regulation, especially in today's environment where environmental regulation is, like, you know, being destroyed everywhere we turn our head, you know, and certainly not being enforced either. So this was, like, luckily France gave us enough of a breathing space to start really reflecting on how to foundationally solve this issue of a lack of incrementality with incremental work. And it was so wild. The solution sort of, you know, came up. It was always there. And you know those things where you realize that it's always in front of you until, you know, but you only realize it when you realize it?
Totally.
Is we started thinking, well, wait a minute, if we can't produce incrementality, we need to take the incremental work to nothing. because these companies are good people. They would do it if there's no work involved. But if I suddenly say there's all this extra work, that's when it becomes problematic. Mm-hmm. And so we reflected on this like crazy, and we realized that the answer in the end was, is there packaging out there already today that is conducive to reuse with actual no changes at all to the packaging? And it turns out, when you frame it that way, a quarter of all packaging is that. Like, think your wine bottle, whiskey bottle, perfume bottle, those heavy laundry detergent bottles, a pickle jar, hot sauce container. I mean, literally 25% of a supermarket is already in packaging that is so strong, so well done. Yeah, like a wine bottle should be able to go around like a ton of times. It's actually way over designed for one use, right?
It's true. It's very, very thick. And also, it's also non-distinctive to the brand, typically. Well, so it doesn't even have to go back to the specific brand. Oh, I mean, I don't know.
It could. Look, a Scotch bottle is highly distinctive, or a perfume bottle is. But either way, that stuff can go around over and over and over. And in evaluating a store, it really works out to about 25% of products fit that description. Thousands and thousands of products. I mean, it's absolutely your Tide laundry detergent bottle all the way to, Drano, all this stuff. Strong enough to go around. And the moment we reframed it and said, look, our job is actually to have the producer do no work, right? Mm-hmm. And that was the instead of fancy package design and reinvent everything and so on, we're going to let you enable reuse, like just snap your fingers and it's done. Oh my God, the thing suddenly exploded, you know? Producers were just like saying, yes, let's go. You know, products are just added onto the system like crazy constantly. Today in France now, it's a very robust system. You can walk into most major supermarkets, over 500 products are available. It's functioning nationally brilliantly. A bunch of retailers just signed in the UK and other countries are now coming on board. But it was all entirely a total 180 degrees, go in the other direction, you know, and focus on this idea of how to really empathize with how, you know, the brands work, not to be frustrated about this reality I painted, but to say, okay, how do we work in the context of they want to do this if there's no incremental work whatsoever?
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's so interesting as an insight. And let me try to universalize it and tell me if you think that I'm on the right path here. So essentially, what you found is that to introduce a big new idea to a marketplace with lots of different stakeholders, you need to find the way in which you reduce the barrier to yes. And so that means not just looking around for what problems can you solve for people, but rather looking for how can I get people on board without really having to do anything? Because the more in which I'm going to ask them to think about this, to put resources towards it, the more in which they have to evaluate that against all their other priorities. But if I can remove that calculation and just show people the fastest pathway to yes, then they're on board.
Exactly. And if I can build like a yes and here, it's at the beginning we were doing that and it was more like a brand would come back and say, oh, well, I'm concerned about the unit economics on the fancy pack versus the non. And then we'd go through this whole work stream explaining how I can solve that for you. So we were solving the concerns by working on them. What we realized even better than that is to say it doesn't exist as a concern, because if you're a wine producer and it's the exact same bottle, you don't have to worry about the unit economic comparison. It's literally the exact same thing, right? So, or, you know, they would say, well, how would we need help on understanding how do we fill the fancy pack? Well, then we do all this work and find them co-packers and get that sorted. But if it's the same bottle, we say, not relevant. It is the exact same production line. And so it's even better than then solving the no, right? Or the, you know, solving the concern, if you will, is eliminating the idea of the concern's existence.
Yeah. And then one other thing that is built into this story that I just wanted to highlight and have you talk about is you ran this experiment in multiple markets and you found that the winning insights had come from France. And I wonder what your guidance is for people who are running their own kinds of experiments on programs, because I would assume that the thing that you did and the reason why you chose different markets was essentially to test lots of different variables. Because if you test it in just one set of variables and it doesn't work, you don't exactly know why it didn't work. And so if you have enough variables, then you might find that in some circumstances something works and then you can learn from that. Is that right?
It's exactly right. I look at it as a roulette table, right? But it's a weird thing in this roulette table is that the numbers are either always hot or never hot, right? It's sort of like Battleship, if you will. You have to discover, And I'm a big fan. It worked here, thank God, because if we didn't put the chip on France, this whole thing would have been gone, right? And I never knew it was France till I knew it, right? It's not like, you could have felt, it's going to be good in France, but let's test some other places just in case. It was, who the hell knows?
Right.
So in a who the hell knows environment, I love trying to, put bets as far and wide as possible, right? Mm. Instead of like all chips on one target, it's just too risky.
Yeah, right. Okay, so Tom, what's the status of Loop right now?
Yeah, so it just turned profitable. It is industrially scaled. So if anyone's traveling to France or in France, you can enjoy it anywhere in the country, probably for any product that you like. It's going to launch next year in the UK. We should see a lot more movement in countries in Europe, partly because the regulatory environment's a bit better. But with this insight I shared, it's not necessary either.
Yeah.
We were just in Tokyo last week. The Japanese folks are very interested in bringing it back based on this learning. And then at some point, we'll also hopefully bring it out to North America. And my gut would be probably like 2-3 years from now.
Amazing. Well, I cannot wait to just bring a wine bottle back to the store instead of tossing it in the recycling. Tom Zaki, CEO and founder of TerraCycle. This has been so interesting. Thank you for all you do. As a lover of recycling, I appreciate it. And as a lover of reuse, I can't wait to reach to be here whenever it gets here.
Thanks for having me.